Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Waitman Bourne, Assistant Professor of History, and the Lewis and Francis Blumkin Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at UNO. The topic of his talk will be Auschwitz, a history of the camp from incarceration to extermination. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, January 17, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Moshe Gershovich, Director of the Middle East Project Fund, the Director of the Natan and Hannah Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, and the Martin Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
I also would like to introduce our speaker for this evening, Dr. Waitman Bourne, who is one of our newest members at the History Department here at UNO, and our newly appointed Lewis and Francis Blumkin Professor of Modern European History, Holocaust and Genocide Study, which is a very long title, but essentially it's a very important addition to our offerings here at UNO, teachings about Holocaust studies and genocide studies as well. And in the short period that Waitman has been with us, he has already began to leave his mark on the place. And I think that probably a good number of the younger people here are his students in his classes that are quite popular. Waitman is a grad, got his BA from the U.S. Air Force Academy at West Point. From West Point. Sorry, I didn't prepare anything in advance, and it shows. Yes. And he is also a veteran of the Iraq War, where he served for several years, and he received his PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And we are very, very pleased to have him with us. He's going to talk tonight about the history of Auschwitz.
Thanks very much to Moshe for those comments. Thanks most of all to Ophir for providing this fantastic exhibit. I'm not going to belabor that point, but please, if you haven't, take a moment and go check it out, because it's got some very great photographs. And many of them are of places that I'm going to speak a little bit about tonight. So what am I trying to do tonight? I want to begin by sort of trying to answer the question, why does Auschwitz dominate in many ways our narrative and our understanding of the Holocaust? Because I would hazard for many of you, Auschwitz and images of Auschwitz, depictions of Auschwitz in the media, in writing, in literature, in film, represent sort of the totality of the Holocaust. I think there's some good reasons why that is the case. But one of the things that I want to do tonight is talk a little bit about what makes Auschwitz unique. Because as a concentration camp, Auschwitz is a very, very complex, or was a very, very complex place. And what I would like to do then is to sort of lay that out for you, all of the different ways in which Auschwitz is a very complex place in the history of it. Why does Auschwitz dominate? Well, in many ways, it is the largest of the camps. In 1944, at the height of its population, it covered 40 square kilometers. These are just the three main camps that we'll talk about tonight: Auschwitz I, Auschwitz II, and Auschwitz III. It had over 135,000 inmates, prisoners, in one of the facilities, to include its sub-camps, of which there were many. And at this point, it essentially accounted for 25% of all of the inmates in the Nazi concentration camp system. So in many ways, Auschwitz is not representative of any concentration camp, because it is its own animal. And I'm going to describe sort of how that takes place. let me run through a little bit of the organization that I want to talk about. The campus will be organized in three different complexes. One operates as sort of what you would normally consider to be a concentration camp, a prison camp for predominantly Polish inmates. Auschwitz II, Birkenau, which is the construction has begun on this in 1942. This is the killing center, the extermination center portion of the camp. And then Auschwitz III, Monowitz, or Buna, depending on how you want to call it, is a factory labor camp where slave labor is employed in the service of the German war industry, in particular, the creation of synthetic rubber. Okay, so what's really unique about Auschwitz is that in one space, you have all of the different elements of the multivariant, complex concentration camp system that the Nazis create. And so I'm going to try to discuss, lay out, show some examples of some of those processes today. I want to begin by talking a little bit about where Auschwitz fits in the progression of Nazi genocide. Okay, as we all know, the Germans, the Nazis, don't begin murdering people on day one. This takes time to develop. And Auschwitz, too, takes time to develop into sort of its low point, if you will, of as an extermination center. So I want to show that. I want to discuss how it became a killing center. I want to discuss a little bit about what it was like to live there, as best I can from a historian standpoint. A little bit about the people who were there, both the inmates and the guards and the staff. And then I want to end with your questions, which I hope you'll have many, because for me, that's sometimes the best part. Okay, so I know that this text is probably difficult to read, and I will get to it in a minute. One of the things that's important to understand in the larger viewpoint of the Nazi genocidal system is that scholars and historians have debated to what extent it was planned from the beginning and to what extent it developed over time as a function of narrowing choices for, in this case, the perpetrators. I'm showing here two important quotations that Hitler himself made. One of them, the top one, comes from Mein Kampf, where he's writing about the Jews. And for those of you that can't see it, this quote says, if at the beginning of the war, and in this case he means World War I, if at the beginning of the war and during the war, 12 or 15,000 of these Hebraic corruptors of the nation had been subjected to poison gas, such as had to be endured in the field of by hundreds of thousands of our very best German workers of all classes and professions, then the sacrifice of millions at the front would not have been in vain. Now, for some people, this is proof positive that from the beginning it was Hitler's intention to physically exterminate the Jews of Europe. And that's certainly one reading of it. Another reading is that this fits into a much larger myth created after the war of the stab-in-the-back theory, that the German army had not actually lost the war and that it had been Jews, capitalists, socialists, war profiteers at home that had caused the defeat. And here he plays also into a larger anti-Semitic stereotype that Jews did not pull their weight in fighting the war. In fact, there was a what's called the infamous Jew count, which the German army ran itself in 1916, that actually showed that Jews were overrepresented in the German army, and therefore this report actually had to be suppressed until the Weimar period, when the truth came out that actually they had been serving above their percentage in the population. So one interpretation of this, then, is Hitler intended from the very beginning to physically exterminate the Jews. The second quote here gets even closer to the point. This is a speech that Hitler gave before everyone in September of 1939. And he says, "Today I will once more be a prophet." He liked being a prophet. "If the international Jewish financiers in and outside Europe should succeed in plunging the nations once more into a world war, then the result will not be the Bolshevization of the earth and thus the victory of Jewry, but the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe. Again, here we have a mixture of different anti-Semitic tropes and potentially a prophecy that leads in the end to the murder, the physical extermination of the Jews of Europe. One thing that I won't necessarily make a judgment either side of that, except to say that if Hitler started out believing this, there were very many Germans who needed some time, very many Nazis in this case, who needed some time to get here. And so if you look at Nazi policy, and we'll talk a little bit about this as I go forward, as policy begins, the goal is most clearly not the physical extermination of the Jews. This is something that becomes clearer and clearer as the war goes on into the 40s, and I'll sort of lay that out for you, because I think an understanding of this development is vital to understanding Auschwitz, the place, and its position in the Nazi killing system. Of course, the Holocaust begins in Germany. It begins with the pseudo-election of the Nazis. The most they ever got in terms of electoral percentage was around 40%. Hitler is able to take power by intimidating the opposition, by sort of convincing the conservative right-wing Germans that he could be controlled, and essentially forcing his way into power from that perspective. But even then, in 1933, when Hitler takes power, he doesn't immediately begin the most drastic of anti-Semitic measures against the Jews. Just like even the Nazis, the Germans would not tolerate this sort of immediate jump to genocide. So there are a series of sort of waypoints along the way. One of these is the boycott that takes place in 1933, arranged by Goebbels and some other key Nazi leaders. They attempt to get the German public to boycott Jewish stores. This is, on the whole, a failure. There is some violence. There are some SA people who stand out in front of Jewish stores trying to prevent people to go in. But on the whole, most Germans find it distasteful. Excuse me. And many of them have developed a personal relationship with the shopkeepers that they patronize, and they just don't participate in the boycott. And it makes Germany sort of look bad in the international press. So actually, Hitler is a little upset with the outcomes of the boycott in 1933. Later on, and this sort of takes place in March of 1933, the Reichstag fire takes place. And those of you who aren't familiar with this, the Reichstag is the German, essentially, Congress building. It's burned down by a group of individuals, some of whom have loose ties to the Communist Party, some of whom are simply mentally troubled. Hitler takes this opportunity to enact a series of laws that essentially grant him martial law for the duration, that allow him to place anyone that is deemed a enemy of the state in what they call protective custody. And this is not protective custody in the context that we think about. This is being arrested and confined without being notified of your charge, without having a trial, without any sort of limit, time limit, to the amount of time you can be confined. Jews are removed from the civil service at this point. In 1935, what are called the Nuremberg Laws are passed. These are laws prohibiting relationships, sexual relationships, and marriages between Jews and non-Jews. Part of a continuing process to alienate Jewish citizens from the remainder of the German population, to divide them, certainly in the eyes of the public, and most definitely in the eyes of the German system. Let me talk a little bit about how we get then beginnings of the concentration camp system. The word concentration camp is first used in the context of the Boer War, at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century in South Africa. The British are fighting an insurgent army, and their idea is they remove the civilian population in which this insurgent army is operating into concentration camps. They concentrate them in camps in order to deprive the guerrillas of material support. So this concept of concentration camp is not the Nazi concept. The Germans, however, themselves take a step toward our more current Nazi understanding of the concentration camp. During the Herero War in German Southwest Africa in around 1900, 1906, in that area. This was a colony known as German Southwest Africa, in which many scholars, myself included, would argue that the Germans perpetrated a genocide against the native black African inhabitants. Part of this included confining them on a place called Shark Island off the coast of Namibia, which was as nice as it sounds, and was designed to allow this group of people to die. In the Nazi context, as I mentioned, concentration camps began in the context of this Schutzhaft, this protective custody context. The majority of the inmates who are confined in the early 30s are not Jews, or if they're Jews, they're not confined because they are Jews. They're confined because they're communists or socialists or other political enemies of the regime. This set of camps from roughly 33 to 36 is designed to destroy the political opposition to Hitler and to intimidate any potential opponents in the future. After Kristallnacht in 1938, which is another sort of stepping stone in the movement towards genocide, Jewish businesses are vandalized, synagogues are burned, Jews are abused and murdered. And immediately following this, there is a wide, massive roundup of Jews. At this point, still predominantly men, but now Jews are being rounded up because they are Jews. And at this point, the goal, again, is not necessarily to even confine them, it's to force them to emigrate. So many of the Jews that are rounded up in the immediate wake of Kristallnacht are essentially forced to hand over their possessions in return for permission to leave Germany. And so many of them do at that point. And of course, many of you may be familiar with Dachau, which is the sort of model camp for the concentration camp system, which opens in 1939. 1939 is a key moment because this is the invasion of Poland. World War II proper begins. For Hitler and for the Nazis, this gives them, in many ways, a cover to begin expediting this process of more and more extreme measures against the Jews. One of the things that we'll notice, the way the Nazi system is set up, first in Germany and then later in Poland and even in other countries such as France and Belgium, is you have a sort of main camp and a sub-camp system. So some of the examples are Buchenwald, Neuengamme, Bergen-Belsen, Dachau, Auschwitz, but they're all associated with tens and even hundreds of sub-camps. And these sub-camps can take a variety of forms, but they all answer to the main office of whatever the main camp is that they're tied to. These camps can take a dizzying variety of forms, from road construction gangs who sort of stay in one place, construct a road, and then they move the camp to someplace else as they build the next set of the road, to factory camps where the inmates are literally living in a factory and performing slave labor for a business such as BMW, Bayer, Siemens, many companies that we're aware of today. They can be hired out to farmers to perform agricultural work. So when one says concentration camp, it's really important to sort of try to define exactly what they mean by that, because there are a wide variety of different installations that would fall under that category. Okay, I mentioned that 1939 was important. Another reason that 1939 is important is because Hitler establishes for himself a big problem. By invading Poland, he has now exponentially increased the population of Jews that he has to deal with, from his perspective. in the pre-war years of the Jewish population of Germany, which was around a half of 1%, so again, not very large, around half of those emigrated, fled Germany, fled the persecutions. So by his view, Hitler had been relatively successful in trying to get Jews out of Germany. By taking Poland, he has now conquered the largest national Jewish population in Europe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 million Jews who live in Poland. And so we see a different process begin here. As Hitler and the Nazis realize that they're going to need to do something with these Jews, we begin to see the ghettoization process, where Jews are confined to specific locations in cities, predominantly, or larger towns. It's also important to note that just like concentration camps, ghettos took a wide variety of forms. Many of you are probably familiar with the Warsaw Ghetto, where we have barbed wire fences and stone walls around it, and everyone is sort of confined. There are other ghettos, like the one here is Bicha, which were open. Jews were sort of free to leave, but they really had nowhere to go because the local Polish population could be antagonistic and because the Germans would round them up if they caught them outside of the ghetto. In Budapest, for example, the ghetto was determined by individual houses and apartment blocks. So you would have a ghetto apartment block right next door to a non-Jewish apartment block. So all of these ghettos take different forms and functions based on the geographic environment in which they find themselves. But it's important, I think, here to point out that none of them are a ghetto in the sense of the medieval Jewish ghetto, which was much more of a community. It was, in some ways, a voluntary and protective function. These are ghettos that are intended to be prisons. They also become essentially holding areas for large populations of Jews to be used either as slave labor or, as the extermination process ramps up, to then be collected before being sent to an extermination center. Okay, I would be remiss to talk about Auschwitz and also about the Nazi genocidal project in the context of the Holocaust without speaking a little bit about the Nazi fantasy of Eastern Europe. Hitler, many Nazis, many non-Nazi Germans, because this goes back way before Hitler, have a sense of manifest destiny in Europe. But for them, their manifest destiny extends east into Poland, into Ukraine, into what is then the Soviet Union. Hitler himself uses the words manifest destiny. Hitler refers explicitly to the Plains Indians and the American experience in the Midwest as an analogy to what he plans to do in the Eastern Territories. And this fantasy dates back to a time in the medieval period when Teutonic knights ruled in small fiefdoms in places like Prussia in western Poland and farther, even farther there, because there are ethnic German communities that dot Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Russia. And for the Germans and for Hitler, Eastern Europe is therefore represented to them their unredeemed land, their irredentist vision of territory they need to reconquer. They're going to conquer France because France is an enemy, but they don't want to occupy France. They do want to occupy and fundamentally transform Eastern Europe into a German colony. And here we can speak of Nazi imperialism and Nazi colonialism, because they had in mind a massive engineering project, a massive demographic engineering process, in which they would remove essentially all of the Slavic populations from large swaths of Eastern European land and replace them with German settlers who would then live in these sort of pseudo-medieval style farms and villages and create a sort of agrarian paradise in the East. This is fundamental to the Nazi worldview. It's fundamental to the Holocaust, and it's fundamental to the war against the Soviet Union, which is also a major component here. So there's this idea of reclaiming this. Auschwitz was never intended to be a Nazi secret. It was never intended to be something that the Nazis weren't proud of. In fact, Auschwitz itself, the camp was only intended to be part of a much larger model settlement for Germans in the East. So Auschwitz is not sort of a dirty little secret that needed to be hidden. It was, in fact, intended to be the model for the German recolonization of Eastern territories, okay? Which would, by the way, also entail the deportation and or murder of around 30 to 60 million Slavs, in addition to the complete eradication of the Jewish population. So the Nazi sort of demographic project was echelons above even the awful severity to which it achieved against the Jewish population. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about Auschwitz. It's important to recognize that Auschwitz is not the name of the town. That's the German name. The name of this town in Poland is Oświęcim. It is an hour or so outside of Krakow, which is a beautiful medieval city. And it was first discovered, if you will, by a SS survey team that was moving through the Polish countryside after 1939 and trying to identify existing structures that could be used for all manner of administrative functions, from prisons to headquarters and these kinds of things. The town itself had a population of around 8,000 Jews, who comprised 60% of the total population of the town. And the story of the Oświęcim Jews, I'm not going to get into it here, but it's actually a really fascinating one, because in many ways they remain unmolested for a very long period of time, even though they are right sort of in the center of the project. This Auschwitz I, which is what we'll talk about right now, is found by these SS surveyors in 1939. They identify a set of former Polish army barracks, and they identify them as potentially a useful location for some form of prison. In 1940, in April, Heinrich Himmler, who is the head of the SS, orders that there be established a prison in these Polish army barracks, and he places a guy named Rudolf Hess in charge as the commandant. So Rudolf Hess becomes the first commandant of Auschwitz, he arrives there, and he has to begin turning this abandoned Polish army barracks into essentially a prison. And he has 22 dormitories, these brick buildings, that he has to work with. And he feverishly sets to work trying to do this. He doesn't have any barbed wire. He has to actually go scavenge barbed wire from an abandoned Polish POW camp. He adds on the second story. All of these brick buildings were really 1.5 stories, and so he adds a second story. And he moves in to a villa, literally within a stone's throw of Auschwitz I, with his wife and 5 children, who are going to live there throughout the entire time that he is the commandant of the camp. The first prisoners of the camp arrive in June 1940. They are almost 100% Polish non-Jews who are involved in anti-Nazi activities, resistance. They can also be priests, anybody who represents some kind of threat to the Nazi regime. And this will sort of characterize Auschwitz I for the duration. There will be Jewish inmates who live here, but this complex is designed as a penal complex, as a punishment, as a prison. And it will continue to serve that way throughout the war. And in fact, one of the photographs that Ophir has taken depicts Block 11 in the camp, and so I highly recommend, if you haven't, go check that out. And Block 11 serves a multitude of roles in the camp and in the surrounding countryside. It is a police station. It is a Gestapo headquarters. It is a makeshift courtroom and I use that word very loosely, and it serves as an execution site. So if you were a non-Jewish Pole arrested for resistance activities, they would take you to Auschwitz I, where you would be investigated, tortured, interrogated, sentenced, and then executed. And that building and that part of Auschwitz I serves that function throughout the context of the war. At the same time, it's important to note that even from the beginning, Auschwitz falls into the slave labor system of the Nazis. And so the workers, the inmates who are confined in Auschwitz I, are being used for a variety of slave labor, almost from the beginning. One of the most obvious uses of this slave labor is actually to build Auschwitz II, Birkenau, on the site of a Polish village where the Polish inhabitants are forced to leave. And Auschwitz II, Birkenau, the extermination center portion of Auschwitz, is actually built by slave labor from Auschwitz I. We'll get to that in a minute. I need to talk now about how do we get to Birkenau? How do we get to the extermination of the Jews? Frequently you hear this phrase, the Jewish question, right? Because the final solution, which is another Nazi term, is the full title of it is the final solution of the Jewish question in Europe. The Jewish question, of course, is the Jewish question in the mind of the Nazis. There really isn't a Jewish question. But in the mind of the Nazis, the Jewish question is, what do we do with the Jews? How do we remove them from our society, both figuratively and physically? And here's where I want to talk a little bit about how this is a progression from victimization to extermination. So when Hitler takes power, his first plan is to force the Jews under his control to emigrate. And the Nazis begin this process through a variety of different techniques. I mentioned some of the laws earlier. Jewish doctors are forbidden from practicing medicine except for Jews. Jewish musicians are removed from orchestras. Really anything you can think about to remove Jews from the economic and public life of Germany becomes codified in law. To include confining relatives in concentration camps and then having them sort of have to pay their way out and then leave the country. We know this is an important goal because when the Germans take over Austria in 1938, there is a particular Nazi official who shows up in Vienna to set up a process of forced emigration for Jews, literally to bring in line all of the different government agencies involved in someone leaving the country, from the police to the tax people to the housing authority, everybody, to create a relatively streamlined process to both force Jews to leave the country and to ensure that they cannot leave with any amount of wealth. This guy's name was Adolf Eichmann. He begins his work in Vienna trying to force Jews to emigrate before he begins organizing the final solution. So this is the first plan. But then we notice that in 1939 or so, the Germans are no longer granting visas to Jews. They're no longer allowing Jews to emigrate, which then makes us begin to question what is the next step. There are several plans that are bandied about by the Nazis in terms of what to do with the Jews of Europe. The first is called the Madagascar Plan, and it seems very outlandish, but there are whole offices of the German administration that are literally working on the logistics of this plan. And the plan is to deport all of the Jews of Europe literally to the island of Madagascar off the coast of Africa, where they will be essentially allowed to starve to death in the context of that island. So it's not an extermination plan per se, but the understood implication of this is that at the very least the Jewish community will be decimated. And there are officials, there are experts working on planning the logistics of this into 1940. However, the Germans quickly realized they do not control the oceans. The British Navy controls the oceans, so it's going to be impossible for them to ship anybody anywhere by boat. So the Madagascar plan falls off the table. This plan is then replaced by a second plan called the Lublin plan or the Nisko plan. And under this plan, all of the Jews of Europe will be placed on a reservation, and this is the word that's used, on a reservation in Poland. there again to be confined and to be reduced by disease and malnutrition. Again, this is explicit in the Nazi documents about this. This plan falls through as well for a couple reasons. The first is logistics. The Germans, the Nazis, are not prepared to make this happen. And secondly, and more interestingly, it falls behind because the Nazi bureaucrat who's in charge of Lublin doesn't want this to happen in his backyard. So there's sort of a not-in-my-backyard phenomenon here. And enough officials sort of throw their weight against this plan that it is vetoed. And the last plan before what I'm going to talk about in a minute is to force all of the Jews east of the Ural Mountains into sort of the wilderness of Eurasian Russia. Hitler has this idea that they will sort of establish a borderland on the wilds in the Soviet Union where Jewish or German men can go prove themselves against the Soviet communist and Jewish hordes that will be trying to get into the empire. When the Nazis are unsuccessful in World War II in Barbarossa, in the invasion of the Soviet Union, this plan goes out the window as well. So in the summer of 1941, we start to see true decisions made in the context of the final solution. One of the first of these is the behavior of the Einsatzgruppen. The Einsatzgruppen are mobile killing squads. There's 3,000 men total who go into the Soviet Union with the German forces and execute communists, functionaries, important village leaders, and Jewish men of military age. They do limit themselves to those categories in the beginning. However, in the late summer, early fall of 1941, these killing squads begin murdering women and children as well, and make no distinction based on age or gender. This is a key that sometime in the meantime, the decision has been made by the Nazi leadership to physically exterminate the Jews of Europe. It's a key moment, because we don't have, there is no order that exists on paper, at least it's been found, where Hitler or Himmler say, okay, ready, go, now we're going to begin murdering the Jews of Europe. So as historians, we have to look for other clues, and there are tons of them. This is one of them. The second one is that the extermination centers, the six extermination centers, whose only mission it is to murder Jews, their construction begins in the late summer, fall of 1941, and they open then in the spring of 1942. Also, around this same time, we start to see the first deportations of German Jews, who up until this point have been confined in Germany, to places in Poland and places in Russia in preparation for transport to these extermination centers. At the same time, getting back to Auschwitz, in October of 1941, construction begins on Auschwitz II Birkenau, the killing center. And by 1943, the population in Birkenau is already 50,000 people. Okay, I mentioned extermination centers. This is a key distinction. Concentration camps are concentration camps. Labor camps are forced labor camps. Extermination centers are those camps whose only mission it was to murder Jews. They had a very, very, very small population of Jews that were kept alive to simply run the day-to-day operations of the camp. There are six of these camps. They are Treblinka, Sobibor, Majdanek, Belzec, Auschwitz, and Chełmno. With the exception of Majdanek and Auschwitz, which are special cases, as I think I've highlighted a little bit already, the other ones become part of Operation Reinhard, named after Reinhard Heydrich, who was assassinated by some Czech resistors. These are the camps where they practice industrial murder. Jews don't live here for more than an hour or so unless you're part of the permanent contingent. There is no work aspect to it. There is no confinement aspect to it. Auschwitz is interesting because it has multiple faces, and one of these faces is Birkenau. How do we get to Birkenau? How do we get to the gassing of Jews in gas chambers, which is the method at Auschwitz? And the way we get there from the Nazi perspective is that they have people who have already been doing this in Nazi Germany in the context of the euthanasia program. They have already developed experts whose expertise is in murdering people, also murdering people with gas, also transporting people from one location to another in order to be murdered and then to hide the tracks of what they were doing. This is the context of the T4 program, which is shut down, incidentally, in 1940, at least officially, due to public outcry. People would get two sets of ashes in the mail, or they would be told that their relative died of appendicitis when he or she had his appendix out years earlier. There was public outcry. Hitler forces this project underground, and all of a sudden he has a large number of experts in mass killing who are out of a job. And it's not surprising that we see many of these same people showing up in the extermination centers in Poland in 1941 and 1942. A notable example is Franz Stangl, who was the commandant of Sobibor and Treblinka, initially began his work in the gas chambers of mental asylums in Austria. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the killing process at Auschwitz. In September of 1941, in Block 11, which I've mentioned already, experiments were made on Soviet POWs using a delousing agent that was in operation and used by the German army to delouse barracks, clothing, et cetera, et cetera. Analogous to some of the anti-flea treatments that you might have today, where you would open it in a room, let the chemical come out, and the chemical would kill any insects. They sealed up the basement of Block 11 and experimented for 2 days on Soviet POWs to determine the feasibility of using Zyklon B, which is the agent, delousing agent, in the context of murdering human beings. Then they turned the existing morgue at Auschwitz I, they turned this existing morgue into a makeshift gas chamber using Zyklon B as the agent. As the demand, if you will, for gassing facilities increases, and then as the policy is made explicit that from now on the goal of the Nazi regime will be to murder the Jews of Europe, we see the beginnings of the creation of an even more industrial format at Auschwitz II. And even while Auschwitz II-Birkenau is being completed, there are two cottages in the neighborhood of Auschwitz I that are sealed and are used as gas chambers. And these are the little white cottage and the little red cottage. So that there's a makeshift element while the rest of it's being built. In 1942, there's a decision that's made to build specialized killing apparatuses in Auschwitz II. I want to pause really quickly and just point out the industrial complicity in Auschwitz, the killing center. The ovens that are used in the crematoria at Auschwitz and elsewhere in the Nazi camp system are created by a firm called Topf and Sons, an existing German firm that specialized in building crematoria for funeral homes in Germany in the pre-war period. They get the contract to build or supply ovens to the SS for use at first in, I don't want to say legitimate, but in normal body disposal of people that die in these concentration camps. But then they start adapting. And after the war, they say, we can't determine what people are going to do with our product. We just sold the product. However, if you look at the gas chambers here, you'll notice that they have a rounded top. And that's significant. Because when you build a crematoria for a funeral home, it has a square top because you're going to put a casket in it. If you make a rounded top, you can actually stack more than one body on top and burn more than one person at the same time, which you would never do in a funeral home environment. So here we already see that this industry, this company, has adapted its product to serve its clientele. There was actually an attempt to patent several designs of crematoria. These men were also building or constructing or designing, trying to figure out a way to burn more bodies. They were constructing buildings that included ventilators, which you don't need in a crematorium unless there is a gas chamber involved. These men arrive at the camp to help install the ovens and help ensure the ventilators are working. So a really powerful example of the depth to which German industry becomes involved in the killing process. Okay, let me talk a little bit about Auschwitz II in operation. using the example of the Hungarian transports, which arrive in 1944. During this series of transports from April to July, around 475,000 Hungarian Jews are murdered, which averages out to roughly 12,000 per day for a lot of that period. Okay. To give you an example, just to walk you through the process, trains would at this point come in. Jews are forced out of the train. They are divided up first by gender. There's a selection that takes place on the ramp, normally attended by a Nazi physician, sometimes by Dr. Mengele, depending on whether he was in the camp at that point and whether or not he needed new test subjects. Those who weren't deemed capable of labor were then sent to the gas chambers. Left or right is immaterial because it depends on which gas chamber they're using. But these people would then move towards the gas chambers. After selection, those going to the gas chambers would arrive at one of four of the crematoria. They'd be met by an SS man who, in many cases, there was a man named Hessler who would give a very long speech about ensuring that you keep your clothes together, ensuring that you correctly, you know, note that you are a worker of various kinds, put your name on things, to try to fool people up until the very last moment. Then SS guards would administer the Zyklon B out of the canister into wire pillars that would drop down into the gas chamber. Zyklon B is basically activated by heat and warmth and moisture, so the more people that are crammed in, the quicker the gas takes effect. Once the victims are dead, the process continues, as I mentioned, in terms of the burning and disposal of the ashes. It's important to note also that even at the extermination endpoint, the Germans are attempting to expropriate money from the Jews. And so all of their property is taken at the ramp because they've been told when they're being deported from whatever ghetto they're being deported from to take their currency, their gold, their silver, their valuables with them because they will need them at their new location. Okay, I'm going to wrap up here very shortly. I just want to point out Auschwitz III in 1942 becomes part of the war industry. This, by the way, is where Primo Levi worked because he was a chemist and he was fortunate enough to get selected, and I use scare quotes for fortunate, to be selected to work in an indoor environment here. Let me talk a little bit about the staff. At its height, Auschwitz employed 4,480 SS men and 71 female SS supervisors. It started out in 1941 with 700, okay? I'm gonna hold off on any sort of larger discussion of the personnel here for the question and answer period, but please, if you have questions about motivations or individual personnel, I'd be happy to cover that. I will mention Rudolf Hess, the first commandant, a devout Catholic who renounces his religion to join the Nazi party. He started out at Dachau in a subordinate position before being promoted to Auschwitz. So sort of Auschwitz is the crown jewel of the system. If you were doing the best you could do, you wanted to be placed there. I can also discuss during the question and answer period the medical experiments that Mengele carries out there. It's important to note that there were frequent, if not always successful, acts of resistance in the camp. Around 800 people escaped during the course of the existence of Auschwitz. Of those, 144 were successful in escaping. One of the most audacious was a group of three Poles who broke into the SS garage dressed in SS uniforms and literally drove out the front gate, pretending to be Germans. There's also a man who's been in the news recently named Witold Pilecki, who was a Pole in the underground army who intentionally was captured in order to get into Auschwitz and report on it. Perhaps the greatest example of resistance at Auschwitz occurred on October 7th, 1944, where the Sonderkommando at Crematorium 4 had stockpiled weapons, some of them which they had gotten from the outside world, and they blew up the crematoria. They pushed at least one SS guard into the oven and fought until they were killed by the SS guards. And that crematory was never reopened after that. Okay, so towards the end of the war, the situation on the Eastern Front is deteriorating rapidly, and the Germans decide to evacuate Auschwitz. And this remains one of the most puzzling aspects of the Holocaust, is why did the Germans take so much effort to evacuate their forced laborers back to Germany? So essentially importing Jews back to Germany. One argument is to keep the armaments industry running. For actual Jews at Auschwitz, this resulted in several major death marches from the camp itself to various railheads, which take place in January of 1945 in Poland, which you can imagine the conditions there are particularly awful. And many, many people die. It's estimated that 60,000 were forced to head out on these death marches, the longest of which was 35 miles in sub-zero temperatures, and at least 15,000 Jews die on these death marches. And then many of them are forced onto later death marches in Germany from place to place as the front collapses. And let me end up with liberation. The camp is liberated on January 27th, 1945, by the Red Army. It's one of the first extermination centers to be liberated. The Nazis were unable to destroy the camp. They did detonate the gas chambers, but otherwise the camp remained intact. 7,000 prisoners who were too sick to leave or who had gambled on staying, Primo Levi's one of these, were liberated at that point by the Red Army. And that sort of ends Auschwitz as a functioning unit. So many of these survivors of Auschwitz actually then have to end up moving on to Dachau, Bergen-Belsen, Mauthausen, any number of other camps in the system before they are finally liberated, often by the Americans. Okay, let me close with one sort of final thought as we think about how Auschwitz has dominated our memory and why it continues to do so. And I think one of the best ways to sort of encapsulate this is the very recent, if you're Polish, you'll say it's a gaffe. If you're me, you'll say it was just sort of a relatively accurate statement. When President Obama referred to the Polish death camps and the Polish citizenry became very upset. And this sort of, in many ways, epitomizes the complex nature of these camps. The Poles did not choose to have Auschwitz placed where it was. It was placed where it was by the Nazis because that was where the Jews were. But for the Poles themselves, who have a mixed record in the Holocaust, many of them were complicit and or rabidly anti-Semitic as well, it's difficult often for them to recognize the very real and, in this case, numerically superior suffering by Jews. So Auschwitz remains, in many ways, a symbolic place for a variety of different groups. And if you go to visit it, I think as Ophir will agree, you'll notice that it becomes very symbolic for lots of different groups of people. And it remains that way because it's so complex. It's a unique place. Okay, I've talked too long already. I appreciate everyone. Thank you very much for coming. I'll be up front if anybody wants to continue on.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Waitman Bourne, Assistant Professor of History, and the Lewis and Francis Blumkin Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at UNO. He spoke on the topic, Auschwitz, a History of the Camp from Incarceration to Extermination. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, January 17, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.